Blog Talk Radio.
This land is mine. God gave this land to me. This brave and ancient land to me. And when the morning sun reveals her hills and plains, then I see a land where children can run free. So take my hand and walk this land with me, and walk this lovely land with me. Though I am just a man, when you are by my side, with the help of God, I know I can be.
Well, that was our best shot at a tarua. I can tell you that Leia can play. I have two taruas, our shofars now. And I can't play either one of Malik, but she can make both of them sing. I have one that's like 2 feet long, and it's beautiful. It's got a menorah on it. It's got the Lion of Judah on it. It is this beautiful swirl long ram's horn. And she can make that thing absolutely scream. It's a beautiful sight, far better than what we just heard. I do want to get to our preamble to PSOC straight away, but I do want to say a couple of things that they came up in the introduction to the show. There are an amazing number of people, unfortunately, many of them who are somehow convinced that they're members of the covenant, who are promoting anti-vaccine conspiracies. And I just ask you to stop. You're making fools of yourself. You have a religious zeal, and it's for you, it's the same as any religious order. You're just desperate to have people believe what you believe. So much of it's tied to the Christian mythology of the Antichrist. Well, since there's no Christ, there is no Antichrist. The whole thing is a bunch of malarkey. A vaccine is not a mind control substance. It doesn't make you receptive to the mark of the beast. And you want the mark of the beast? Read the Christian New Testament.
Yeah.
It's Paul.
Oh,
it's just the whole thing is just utter BS. And it's frustrating. Now, there are a lot of things, and in future shows, that Kirk, we will have to talk about them. And that is that the economy now is nothing but a bubble. And it's going to burst, and it's going to be a far worse outcome than was experienced in 1929 because the conditions are far worse. So we will have to talk about what do we expect as the next in this play that is marking the degradation and ultimate demise of human existence. So that's an important thing to cover. And they're not conspiracies. They are just right in your face facts, economic facts, political facts, as to what the Nimrods have done to this country and to the world. But we have something that I didn't expect to be much of anything. Kirk, I had started better part of a year ago now, rewriting all of the books under the Yada Yawa series. And thus far, I think I have, to put it in perspective, 2 feet, 24 inches of books. I'm looking at my bookshelf here, and of the books that have been edited, rewritten in this new series, there's every bit of 2 feet of books, just looking at them from the spine. I think it's 15 volumes. And I had hoped that we would get Questioning Paul done expeditiously so that I could return to volume four of Yada Yawa, which is the first of two volumes on the Moed Mikra. The first one would be called Vikra, the second volume, which would be the fifth volume of the Yada Yawa series of Moed. And I did get to it prior to Pesach. We've written a chapter and a half on it, and we're going to begin tonight a series based upon the prelude to Pesach, and we'll get to Pesach. But Kirk, I sent you the chapter, Mitzrayim, Crucibles of Oppression,
yes.
leaving man's world. I did not anticipate that the preamble would be as rich with insights as it is. God doesn't just say, and this is a terrible thing, that the Jews around the world are celebrating Pesach as a Jewish religious festival. It's not Jewish, it's Yahweh's. And they are doing it in Canaan fashion. By Canaan fashion, there's everything on the plate but lamb. So they put a bone, a zeroa, on the plate, but you can't eat it. All you do is chip a tooth. So they're making the offering of Cain. And it's a tragedy what they have done. It's an absolute travesty. And there's not, I don't think, a single in all of Yisrael that tonight is celebrating Pesach in the manner that Yahweh intended, as the doorway to life, the doorway to his home, in conjunction with matzah, such that we are purified of religious and political corruption. We're purified of Mitzrayim in the process. The last thing you want is Pesach without matzah. I was telling Leah tonight that, well, the lamb was the best I've ever eaten. But I began with the Pesach. And I ended, I began with the matzah, and I ended with the matzah, and I was constantly telling her, I need more matzah. I don't know about you, but I always want more matzah. Even though it's all symbolic at this point, I love the symbolism of having my soul cleansed of religious and political corruption.
And surrounded by
what? Yeah, and we're surrounded by all forms of corruption, and so today is Pesach matzah, the two combined, so that we not only have eternal life but are perfected and cleansed of religious and political corruption simultaneously. Yeah. So let's begin this prelude to our liberation. God is insistent that we leave the corruption and the persecution of humanity before we enter his home. The story begins with these words. These are the personal and proper names of the children of Yisrael who arrived in Mitzrayim, the crucibles of political and religious oppression, the cauldrons of coercions and cruelty in Egypt, where the people were confined and restricted by religious and political institutions. It's the plural of matzor, to be delineated as a foe and besieged during a time of testing and tribulation. What I didn't really think about and realize until quite recently is Mitzrayim, the actual root of Mitzrayim, is Shur, T-S-U-W-R.
Mm-hmm.
When we speak of the time of Jacob's troubles is Shur. It's to be bound and confined by an adversary. besieged, assaulted, shut up, and enclosed in the likes of a concentration camp by those showing great hostility. These are the personal and proper names of the children of Yisrael from Yisrael, the individuals who strive and struggle with the Almighty, and those who engage and endure with God, who arrived in Mitzrayim, the crucibles of political and religious oppression, with Jacob, their father, each individual and his household included. This is the opening line of Shemoth names Exodus. Now, you mentioned before we began the show that every aspect of Mitzra, and then the plural Mitzrayim, is derogatory. It is a very revealing word.
Exactly.
Yeah, it's the plural of Matzor, the consequences of a crucible of oppression where people are delineated as foes, besieged and subjugated, confined and restricted by man's religious and political institutions. This is important because what is the purpose of Pesach and Matzah? For us to walk through the door that liberates our souls from religious and political corruption, from Mitzrayim. We are celebrating our liberation from Mitzrayim because we're celebrating our celebration, our separation from religion and politics. Matzor, in turn, is a compound of ma, to ponder the implications of something, and sur, to be bound and confined by an adversary, besieged, assaulted, shut up, abused, and enclosed in what can be described as a concentration camp by those showing great hostility. This was a word that you looked up, didn't you, before we began the program?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. You hit everything on the head. It goes down to, it's also Sur is a proper name of a heathen god. It also includes rocks and sharp edges and cliff fortifications and compounds. And then I even looked up the two-letter root. There's more, but I looked up the two-letter root, which means to press, to crush, to strike, to tear an enemy. Flint is important because it's how you make weapons with arrows as well as spears. To prey upon, trouble and pain. I mean, it just goes on and narrow. Tight places or situations, the enemy that closes in or pressures you. It makes you...
When I stopped translating Mitzrayim as Egypt, as Egypt is a Egyptian name for the country, not Egyptian. It's a Greek name. If you were to ask an Egyptian today, what do you call your country? They're going to say Mitzrayim. So the name Mitzrayim, plural, is the same name that is used today. And that name is so rich with meaning, and it's so easily, from its etymological history, deduced that it's a crying shame that we don't explain what it was that God was liberating his people. And Mitzrayim is the crucibles of human, religious, and political oppression. And the more you study the word, the more obvious it becomes.
So why did the translators not use Mitzrayim? I mean, I do not know.
What they do is they replace Mitzrayim with Egypt.
Yeah, with Greek.
Why would you replace Yahweh's Hebrew definition of the place, which is still used today, that is rife with meaning, and describes exactly what Yahweh is liberating us from, with a Greek word? Greece was still at this point, 8 centuries from even existing? Now, I know it's mind-boggling that we work so hard to confuse the message. One of the names in this, though, that has always been a challenge for me to translate is Jacob. Jacob is one of the Torah's most difficult names, I think, to properly define. It is a compound of Y, the pronoun I and me, and Akab, which could be nothing more than my footsteps as a result of me grabbing the heel, something Yahweh or Jacob did as he tried to supplant his brother's birthright. We could contemplate the full array of meanings ascribed to a ka, but we find that it means to receive the reward or suffer the consequences of circumventing or overreaching, digging in or supplanting one's heels, often walking in a sly, accusatory, and insidious manner. When you look at Jacob, most of the word is not flattering. In fact, it's hard to get a flattering definition of, realistically, if we study the history of Yisrael, it's pretty hard to get a flattering depiction of Yisrael. I mean, look today, Israel. Listen, I'm not a Netanyahu fan because he's elected based upon pandering to the most religious of Jews, and I think an Orthodox halak Jew is among the most disgusting individuals on the planet. And I'm not saying that as an assault on an ethnicity. This has nothing to do with racism or anti-Semitism. Mm-hmm. It's a deliberate criticism, a bold and blunt criticism of the religion. It is insipid. It is stunningly ignorant. It's irrational. And it's one thing for Goyim, who are ignorant of the Torah, to be stupid. It's another thing for Muslims, who are completely ignorant of anything that is reasonable or rational, to be religious. But there's no excuse for Jews. And for them to screw it up, for them to miss everything that God said and to be opposed to Him, for them to pretend like they're celebrating Pesach and have a plate full of vegetables, for crying out loud. God damn the religion of Orthodox Judaism. Eliyahu, when he returns as the witness, has got a hell of a job. God wants to reconcile his relationship with Yisrael, and yet he has to be far more disgusted at Orthodox religious Jews than I am.
Oh, sure.
But if you look at Jacob, at the name Jacob, so much of it is negative. And so perhaps the reason for that is that he represents Israel.
Well, yeah.
And they are a really good, bad example. Doesn't change the point. They're God's people. They're always going to be God's people. He wants to call his people home. I've devoted the last 20 years of my life to calling God's people home. But I recognize that few listen. No one who is religious listens. They aren't worth saving. And those who are secular, there is the hope. And so much of what we're going to read through in this chapter speaks directly to Yisrael, and hopefully we find some receptive ears among the children of Yisrael. So I don't know if you found anything that I missed, but as I say, Jacob is always a tough one for me. It's never one that I'm able to translate easily, which is why I'm really glad that Jacob was replaced by Yahweh. It's kind of the placeholder now for Yisrael. And Yisrael is perfect in that Yisrael has two very different meanings. It's either the individuals who strive and struggle with God, or those who engage mm-hmm. and endure with God. And there's lots of them.
No, you're on the money about everything. There's a few little adjectives in there the English use, but it's none of them are anything to be proud of.
Now, yeah, I grab the heel. I supplant. I mean, I take the birthright.
Yeah. So, yeah. A qual, a quib.
Now, there's a few more names here. This is a really interesting thing. The prelude to our redemption continues with Yahweh's list of names. ostensibly because the meanings of the names and the fact that they're not listed in the order of their birth was intended to convey a message. Here are the names. Reuben, from Ra'ah and Ben, see and perceive, look upon and behold, considering the Son, who is an observant prophet and witness. Reuben.
Yes.
Shimon, from Shammah, listen to and hear everything which is associated with him. Loi, from Loah, to be united with and joined to. Yauda, from Yahuwah and Yada, the hand of Yah, beloved of Yah, related to Yah, to acknowledge and appreciate Yah, and to know and understand Yah.
Let me toss one thing in about Yah.
Yeah.
Just, you know, if you look at the letters, there's something rather unique about the word. I mean, it's really Yahweh's name, and all it is they've added the Passover door, the Pesach door.
Yes, it's true.
And, you know, so. So
yeah, Yahuda. Yeah, Yahweh's name plus a four.
Yeah, you can if you can't find what you're looking for as far as being
right.
Yahweh's people.
So if you want to find the door to Yahweh, look at Yahuda, and particularly the beloved of Yahuda,
Yahweh. Mm-hmm.
And of course Yahusha,
yes.
Opening the door. Issachar, from Nasa, and Shakar, meaning to lift up and support the reward. Paying the fee to carry away and provide safe passage. Zebulun, from Zabal, to live life abundantly and to dwell in the majestic and lofty abode. Benjamin, from Ben and Yamen, son of the right side and hand, choosing to be the son who is right, or a child of the sea.
Got a hole right there. Every one of these names are introduced by, and the mother named him. Benjamin,
yes.
his mother named him.
Yeah.
Benoni. The son of my vanity. It means vanity or effect or put
pain.
Something in.
My trouble. Yeah, my agony.
Yeah. Trouble, sorrow, wickedness.
Yep.
Put into something that has no results. I think, just personally, I think if they had not printed Benjamin and used Benoni, it would have been a lot easier to identify Shaul.
Yes. Yes, it would have.
And relate it. So
yep.
It should be at least side by side.
But again, Yahweh's
mm-hmm.
goal is not to make it easy.
I know. No joke.
God's goal is to make it interesting.
Yeah.
You know, easy is a waste of time. Interesting is this journey of discovery. It's not hard to figure out who Benjamin was before he was Benjamin. And you're right that all the mothers named every one of these boys, and she named him Benoni, son of my anxiety and trouble and anguish and persecution.
Mm-hmm. Daddy didn't like
before
it.
Or his father renamed him after he killed his mother in childbirth.
Yeah.
Then we have Dan from Den to execute good judgment or to be contentious, to vindicate or to quarrel. Naphtali. Naphtali is from Patal and E, Y. I go forward striving alongside, or I can twist and distort. God, from God and good, to fortuitously gather together in abundance with good fortune, expressed in joy, and to be overcome by invading troops. And then Asher, from Asher, revealing the way to the benefits of the relationship and being led along the narrow path to get the most out of life.
That's a good name.
As a complete family, the message becomes, perceive and consider the Son, who is an observant prophet and witness. Listen to everything associated with him to become united with those who acknowledge and appreciate Yah, joining the beloved of Yah to become related to Yah as a reward. Let him pay the price to carry you away, providing safe passage to live an abundant life in the majestic and lofty abode, at the right side, having chosen to identify the Son who is correct. Exercise good judgments to be vindicated rather than be contentious. Strive forward and alongside rather than struggling amidst that which is twisted and distorted. Fortuitously gather together an abundance of good fortune by being led along the path to the benefits of the relationship. That's what those names convey in that order.
Mm-hmm.
It's little wonder that the second book of the Torah was designated Shemot names. And fortunate for us, we took the time to consider them.
Well,
and all of the souls, it's just a marvelous list. We're going to come across so many things in this chapter, which you could just read the names and go on. Or you could say, why is it this way? Why did God list the names out of order? Well, it was to convey a message. And when it's done this way, where we have the opportunity to think and discover, it's so much more rewarding and fun for us and for God. And all of the souls who came to exist out of the loins of Jacob were 75 souls, because Yosef was in Mitzrayim, the crucibles of political and religious oppression. So here we have all of the souls, so that's nefesh, individual consciousness, who came to exist out of the loins of Jacob, my footsteps, were 75 souls, again nefesh, because Yosef is Yahweh adds and increases those who make the proper connections to join together with him, was already in Mitzrayim, the cauldrons of coercions and cruelty. Yosef, now there's an easy name to translate. Yahweh makes or increases those, he magnifies those who make the proper connections and join together with him. Was that a name you also studied?
Yeah, I'm trying to find it. Yeah, it is. It adds another to continue, exceed, increase repeatedly, augmented by increasing supply. All of those gave birth to his... It's first found in Genesis 4:2, where it's used as a other verb is, where it's used where Chawa gives birth to Cain's brother Hebel, so they're increasing her children.
Mm-hmm.
It's the letters are a the yod is a authority, ability to work, power, heavy lifting. That's quite a good name. The Shemek is a thorn, pierce to grab and to shield, and then the pay, of course, is to speak, to communicate language, and edge, and or the edge of the mouth for talking of Israel. And it's if you really look at them, and all the numbers add up to three yobels. I don't know whether that's significant or not, but I always find it kind of odd when they come out that way or something of that nature.
Well,
but,
3 cents of yobel years is the history of man. That's the history of man from the garden to the garden.
Okay. I'll pretend like I figured that out.
Yeah, there you go.
I knew it was three yobel years.
Yeah, three yobels.
Then
the children of Yisrael were fruitful, multiplying by becoming innumerable, exceptionally influential and accomplished, such that the region was filled with them. Then a previously unknown king rose up and took a stand over Mitzrayim, the crucibles of political and religious oppression, who did not know Yosef. He said to his people, "Behold, the sons of Israel have obtained a high status and are numerous, and they are too powerful a multitude for us." 1:9. So we have Jews doing what Jews do in every culture. They succeed.
Make it better.
They make it better. They were fruitful. They were influential. They were accomplished. And they proliferated. And then somebody came along that decided he was going to start a conspiracy and said, "I don't like those guys. We better watch out. They're going to get us." What all these conspiracy nuts, you know, think that the Jews are conspiring to do and perpetrate genocide on Gentiles, when, of course, the opposite is a historical fact.
Yes.
And so they don't like the status of Jews. That's what this guy said. They have obtained a high status. You know, they think that we think that the conspiracy Jews are manipulating everything. Oh, they're way too powerful. Good God. You know, if the Jews were even 1% as influential as the conspiracy nuts make them out to be, good God, we ought to be worshiping them. But they're not. And most of them are lost.
Yeah.
They're just beginning to find their way home. It was not the first, nor would it be the last time, that the oppressive sting of religious, political, and economic oppression had been justified through jealousy and fear. Once empowered, Muhammad said the same thing. He reacted the same way, enslaving, killing, raping, and robbing every Jew within his grasp. The moment he rose to power, Hitler said the Jews were the problem, and that they had become too powerful, and that they had allied with the enemy. So the author of the Volkspeople's Religion enslaved and robbed millions of Jews throughout Europe. All three men, including Pharaoh, justified degrading, oppressing, and enslaving, even murdering Jews en masse by suggesting that they were elitists. They were too influential. They were too rich. They were too numerous, too powerful, and too manipulating for us to endure. It has become the most pervasive and destructive conspiracy ever foisted on a disgruntled and covetous people. For those, by the way, that want to continue with their conspiracies, let me remind you that in all of the academic study of conspiracies, there's only one common denominator. Conspiratorial nutcases are young and old, they're rich and poor. They're liberal and conservative, they're men and women. They're religious and they are secular. But they have one thing in common, their lives stink. And they're looking for someone to blame for the sorry state of affairs that they're enduring, rather than accept personal responsibility. That is you, if you are an advocate of conspiracy. Man covets, especially power, and power corrupts. It is the sum and substance of every political and religious doctrine. Humankind has been plagued by a countless variety of such schemes, all conceived for the enrichment and empowerment of clerics and kings, to the detriment of all others. So the Pharaoh said, "Come now, let's take action. Let's deal shrewdly with regard to them, lest they increase in power and influence." Then, what if it comes to be that we are called to fight a war, and in addition, they join forces so as to increase the presence of those who hate us, such that they fight against us, and then they withdraw from the land?
And these people just saved Egypt.
Yeah.
The backdrop for that, these people just saved Egypt.
Good. How many hypotheticals did this Nimrod need to create a fearsome boogeyman? Let's deal shrewdly with them. Why don't you look in the mirror? Lest they increase in power. That's to say, they don't have enough power and influence now to be of any trouble. But they might. They will. And it comes to be that we are called to a war, and they join forces with the other side because of the way we've abused them. But they fight against us, and then they withdraw. Let's line up about four or five hypotheticals and pretend that four or five hypotheticals makes a theory. This idiot's name was probably Neferhotep. He was lying, and he knew it, not unlike George W. Bush's errant justifications for the invasion of Afghanistan and the Iraqi war. Yawup presented his historical review so that we might appreciate the desperate and delusional nature of the religious and political aspirants from whom he is saving us. For far too many beguiling clerics and kings have made such states. Therefore, they placed over them political and military officials, czar, commanders, soldiers, and nobility, madmen who imposed forced labor, mosh, the insane and irrational individuals possessed by evil spirits as taskmasters over them, making vassal slaves of them on behalf of a lord for the purpose of oppressing and subjugating them with difficult work. I had an occasion this morning to look up the caste system in Babylon because Leah came in and said, you know, Hammurabi's code is based on the caste system. And I said, I bet it's the same caste system that existed in Babylon and Persia and Egypt and the Holy Roman Empire all the way through, Rome, Greece. And so I looked up the caste system of all those cultures, all those civilizations. Mm-hmm. They're the same. Everyone had a caste system. That's what this is talking about. We're going to have a slave caste. And so you have the monarchs, the kings. Oh, they're at the top of the totem pole. Hammurabi, boy, was he full of himself. They're all at the top of the totem pole. They all claim to be gods. They all claim that they're authorized to rule, that they have total autonomy. They own everybody. They're infallible. And below them, of course, the nobility, the royal families. And immediately below them are the priests, the religious who integrate the politics and the religion so that they get you coming and going. They control every aspect of everyone's life. And it's surprising. You was underneath them and almost all these cultures, with the military, exception of some aspects of Rome, the military. And Rome, you did have the equestrian class, which was the highest ranking of six classes of people below the patricians. But it doesn't matter the culture. They're all the same. And then, you know, underneath them, you might have merchants underneath them, farmers underneath them, peasants, and underneath them, slaves.
Of course.
All of them. Egypt wasn't unique. What do you think the feudal system was in Europe under the Holy Roman Empire?
That's
Imperial Rome, the Roman Church, the Holy Roman Empire, all the same. While there were slaves, the serfs were essentially slaves. They couldn't have no mobility. They were chattel property. And so that is the history of man. It's not just that Mithraim is a place of slavery and a caste system, and the caste system in Egypt was exactly the same as all of these others, under Pharaoh and Pharaoh's family. Then you have the priests, and under the priests, then you have the aristocrats and the nobility, and under them you have the military, and under them the engineers and the physicians and the scribes, and immediately underneath them you have the traders and the merchants, and underneath them you have the farmers, and then the peasants, and then the slaves. All the same. Never changes. And so that is what God is trying to free us from. It's the oppression and the persecution and subjugation of human religious and political schemes. That is what Marx is all about. That is what Pesach is all about. You want to understand Pesach and Matzah, you need to understand that Mitzrayim is symbolic of all of it, of every civilization. It doesn't matter if you're the Mayas or the Incas or the Aztecs or the Polynesians, the Carthaginians, the Punics, the Spartans, the Greeks, the Mycenaeans, the Minoans, the Romans, the Greeks, the Persians, the Babylonians, the Assyrians, in India, in China, Japan. It's the same. It's the history of the world. And so God is saying that before we do anything, I need to liberate you, to free you, to separate you from religious and political oppression. In this section, this is the only section of the Torah where Yahweh speaks of his people as Ibri, Hebrews, mm-hmm. Ibri.
Yeah,
you know what the primary meaning of Ibri is?
Yeah, it's to cross over.
Those who are opposed, those who are on the other side. The other side of what? The other side of human, religious, and political subjugation.
Right. Go from slavery to freedom.
Yes. They're the other side. That's what the word means. Therefore, they placed over them political and military officials, madmen who opposed forced labor for the purpose of oppressing and subjugating them with difficult work.
Madmen. Wow.
Yep. Oppression and subjugation are the antithesis of freedom and free will. They are therefore mankind's greatest foe. They serve to keep people from knowing Yahweh, from choosing to trust and rely upon it, from being free to live eternally with him. And since love requires choice, oppression, which suppresses free will, is especially vulgar to God. Throughout human history, there have only been two entities capable of oppression and subjugation: political schemes and religious regimes. While militaries are the means of oppression and political and religious officials are the implements, they're merely tools wielded by political despots and religious clerics. When we discover that people have been oppressed and subjugated, we know that religion and politics are to blame. They all too often, as was the case with Mitzrayim then and now, religion and politics are inseparable. Such has been the case throughout most of human history. Look at General Sisi, who's the president now of Mitzrayim, of Egypt. He's a fundamentalist Muslim wacko.
Mm-hmm.
Who stays in power because of America's aid and weapons. Now, speaking of Mitzrayim, by his depiction of what was imposed upon his people, the definition that we have been using to define this place as the crucibles of religious and political oppression is an adroit fit. While oblivious from, or sorry, I should say that it's oblivious, it's actually obvious. You have to be oblivious if you don't see the obvious connections from the etymology. God has now confirmed it through context. What he is liberating us from through Pesach, Matzah, and Bikurim, the 3 days, is religious and political oppression. This leads us to the conclusion that Yahweh freed his children and us by extension from man's political and religious schemes.
Question.
Mm-hmm.
Is it unfair to ask someone if they are spouting off about why they are oppressed to look at your politics and your religion first?
Yeah.
I mean, is that not what controls it? I mean, even to this day, in every aspect of our society.
Yes.
If you're really feeling oppressed, think about who's talking to you.
Yeah. If you're conspiratorial because your life is miserable, why don't you look at the political and religious influences on it? And then you'll understand why your life is so miserable. You have to break free of that. Mm-hmm. They built on behalf of Pharaoh cities and shrines, warehouses near Pithom, and in associations with Ramesses. This is Shemot, Exodus 1:11. And one of the interesting things there is that here is the Torah written around 1445-44-ish mm-hmm. BC, mm-hmm. with the 22-letter phonetic alphabet. And it's providing the names of the Hebrew towns, including Ramesses, what, about 3,400 years prior to the Rosetta Stone? Tell people how to pronounce it?
Duh.
I mean, come on, folks, think it through.
That's pretty good. Yeah.
And even Pharaoh. Pharaoh is phonetically presented as Pharaoh.
Yeah, I know
you
that.
You know, 3,400 years before the Rosetta Stone. But as is the nature of oppression and subjugation, this actually made them much stronger and more numerous. So then they began to detest and fear the very presence of the children of Israel. And so did the Roman Church. So did the Nazis in the Third Reich. So did the Muslims. And on it goes. But I'll tell you what. I did want to go into the news today, but I said, you know, we need to postpone that so we can make some progress into this prelude to Passover. But all the news today is just so anti-Israel. And I'm so sad for Israel, even with, as I say, with Netanyahu being empowered because of his religious affiliations with the ultra-Orthodox. The fact of the matter, why would you, as a nation, replace a man who, with the Abraham Accords, just found four Islamic countries that have normalized their relationships with you and is within a whisper, of getting Saudi Arabia to normalize relations. And you would toss that out, a man that has forestalled giving the West Bank to the Muslims and your own demise, and you would vote him out because of what? Because you didn't like the lockdowns associated with the coronavirus? Okay. But you got nobody better. That is a self-inflicting wound on Israel. To appreciate the story of liberation being portrayed throughout the Torah, we must understand the conditions from which God's people were being rescued. Most ancient empires were built by slaves, including Sumer, Babylon, Assyria, Egypt, China, Sparta, Greece, Rome, the Mayans, Aztecs, and Incas. The Islamic conquests of much of the known world were fueled through the slave trade. Roman Catholicism was the catalyst behind the feudal system of serfdom throughout Europe. Even the American South grew to a significant degree by the sweat of slaves.
Mm-hmm.
So the message is, mankind can involuntarily serve cleric, king, and nobleman, or we can choose to have God serve us. And the children of Israel worked for Mitzrayim, the crucibles of oppression, under a ruthless and brutal tyranny. He anguished and embittered their lives through abusive and cruel slave labor, churning clay, mortar, and mud into sun-dried bricks, in addition to all kinds of laborious tasks in the open fields. with all of their work, which they labored, they treated them ruthlessly. What's the enduring value of a sun-dried brick comprised of mud?
I hope it just crumbles. It's got to have something in it. It's got to have straw.
Put a bunch of straw in it. So what's the enduring lifespan of a bunch of sun-dried bricks comprised of mud and straw?
Oh, I don't know, maybe 60 years, 70 years before it crumbles.
So over the 6,000 years of human existence, is any of it meaningful? Did they create for the Egyptians anything about it? Does anyone say, let's go to Goshen and look at the crumbled bricks? What a waste of time. They abused them because they could.
Yeah.
They got nothing for it.
Sure.
The larger and more intrusive the government, the more abusive it becomes, and the less freedom people have over their lives and careers. As the American government has grown, freedom has declined. We see this in every socialist, communist, and fascist, the Islamic fiefdoms, today. The more liberal the government, the fewer liberties enjoyed by the people. Throughout history, this has also been manifest within every civilization. It gets back to gang mentality. The larger the gang, the more degenerate its mentality. Socialist secular humanists have been advancing the notion that a reduction in population would be good for our planet. They prefer the nationalization of workers. Pharaoh, however, beat them to it. Working the Hebrew population to death served as a harbinger of what the National Socialist German Workers Party did to Jews in their concentration camps.
Hmm.
Then Pharaoh, written as Pharaoh in Hebrew, instructed all of his people, announcing everyone of the sons who are born to them, throw him into the river, letting only the daughters live. Isn't that amazing?
Wow. Yeah.
Fire up the gas chambers. Now a man from the household of Loewy went to obtain a Loewy woman. When she was unable, she gave birth to a child. And when she was unable to conceal him any longer, she obtained for him a papyrus vessel and waterproofed it with tar and with pitch. And she placed him within it, this child of hers, and she set it within the reeds on the edge of the river. We know who that child of promise grew up to be. Now, the Pharaoh's daughter descended to bathe at the river while her maidservants walked at her hand by the river. Then she saw the papyrus vessel in the midst of the reeds, and she sent one of her female servants, and she grasped hold of it. When she opened it and saw the child, she noticed that the baby, like a lamb away from his flock, was crying. Pharaoh's daughter showed mercy toward him. She said, "This baby boy is from the Ibri, the Hebrews, the opposite side."
Yeah.
A little compassion in a story without very much of it.
Hmm.
Now it came to be that after many days, when Moshe had become great, he went out to his brethren, and he observed the burden of their forced labor. Then he witnessed a mitzri, individual striking and beating, nakah, afflicting, destroying, wounding to the point of death, an Ibri, a Hebrew man, one of his brothers. Shemoth, Exodus 2:11. Kirk, my friend, there is a time to kill. There are circumstances in which the most merciful thing to do is to take the life of another. The Egyptian taskmaster was an implement of a diabolical and deadly political and religious regime. Without cause, he was beating an innocent man to death. And there was little doubt that he had done the same thing yesterday and would do it again tomorrow, if given the chance.
Absolutely. That's the point.
This solitary event serves as a microcosm for the conquest of the Promised Land. Those who had become naturally cruel and abusive, even deadly, would have to be removed for God's people to live. Now, that said, unless we're in the exact same situation, witnessing a brutal individual in the throes of beating a helpless and innocent family member to death, we ought not respond in kind. Excuse me one second. I must have said something that tripped the device in my room. We will be more careful. Who knows what the word was that was the wake up. What I was sharing is that unless we are in the same situation, unless we are witnessing a brutal individual in the throes of beating a helpless and innocent family member to death, we ought not respond in kind. Violence breeds more of the same. Words wielded wisely are almost always more effective than fists, bullets, and bombs. Oh, did you see the story out of Colorado with the vice president's daughter saying that the mass shooter there had to be a white man? And she then gets caught because it happened to be a Syrian, a Middle Eastern Syrian, Muslim, perpetrated the deed. And then she, rather than apologize, she digs herself in deeper, saying that white men are the greatest terrorist threat to the world today. And she got all of this life lesson from the woman who sits in the Oval Office, or next to the Oval Office as Vice President of the United States. We have degraded so far as a nation that rather than blame the incentive for killing, which in this case was Islam, we blame the implement. We blame the implement, not the incentive. Indeed sad. He turned this way and that, and seeing no one, he struck and killed the Mithra. Then he concealed him in the sand. Now, let's be clear. Moshe was right only because there was no other option. Words would not have mattered. Cruel beatings would have continued. The Egyptians were absolutely and unequivocally wrong. And even then, Moshe suffered the consequences of standing up against a misguided culture. This is where it gets really interesting. One of the most profound lessons for God's people, and yet here, even as we celebrate Passover, I don't think there's one in a million Jews that understands it. And yet they celebrate Passover as if it were a celebration of their history. When he went out the next day, he beheld two Hebrews who were quarreling, were fighting, afflicting and destroying one another, wounding each other to the point of death by way of repeated blows. And he said to the man in the wrong, "Why are you choosing to make physical contact with, to strike and afflict your fellow countrymen?" He answered, "Who set you in charge? As a judge over us, who set you in charge? Who placed you as the individual who is a high-ranking official, as a judge, Washafat, as someone who decides choosing to convict or acquit over us. Will you kill me, as it is said that you killed the Mitzri? As a result, Moshe was concerned, and he said to himself, this statement is accepted. It's known.
Everywhere.
It has been acknowledged. My fellow covenant members, we can move on. We can believe the myth that all's well that ends well. Or alternatively, we can deal with the realization that this Hebrew's response to someone trying to protect and save him, even encourage him to think about what he was doing to harm his brother, has become a character flaw throughout the generations. Substitute Yahweh for Moshe and Yisrael for the man who, after afflicting his kin, rebuked the one trying to help him. And we can appreciate what God has endured from his people. Yahweh has personally engaged to protect Yisrael, to free his people, and to save them from those who would harm them. Then, after demonstrating his concern and compassion, after standing up for them, they have dismissed him. He has asked those inflicting the deadliest religious and cultural blows upon their brethren to think about what they were doing throughout the Torah and prophets, and yet they're not listening. Instead, they have rejected Yahweh, his name, his authority, his word, his concern, his mercy, and his offer to save them. They have put themselves in charge, with rabbis acting as judges, as the ones who decide the fate of Jews.
Like today.
So,
yeah,
under these circumstances, especially among the religious, this question lingers. Will Yahweh walk away and allow them to die at their own hand and through the blows of others? Do you, Yada? Well, Yahweh answered this question. Moshe walked away. He allowed his people to reject his compassion, to reject his concern, to reject his willingness to protect them, even his attempt to get them to assess their situation and respond differently. He would leave them to suffer under the Mitzri, the oppressors, for another 40 years.
Boy, that's interesting, isn't it?
The designated time of testing. It was only then, and only after all Yisrael pleaded with God to save them, that at Yahweh's pleading to save them, at Yahweh's pleading, Moshe would return to save them. Yahweh provided them with answers and led them to the promised land, but it was only after all of this.
Yeah, it took
but
a
that's not the end of the story.
Yeah.
Yahweh will make one final attempt to reconcile his relationship with his people, doing so on Yom Kippurim in year 6000 Yah, sunset in Jerusalem, on October 2nd, 2033. In advance of his return, he is still encouraging his people to think, to stop them from fighting each other, providing them with all of the answers so that they would yada yada. As a listener, your natural inclination may be to move on, to listen to what comes next without pausing long enough to let what Yahweh just revealed resonate within your heart, your mind, and soul. But please, it has been 3,500 years since God shared this with us, hoping that we would ultimately come to terms with who he is, what he is offering, and what we have done to sweep it all aside
He has waited long enough, and he deserves better.
Yeah, that's so sad.
I would never have thought that one line could inspire so many appropriate insights. When he went out the next day and beheld two Hebrews who were quarreling and who were fighting, afflicting, and destroying one another, wounding each other to the point of death by way of repeated blows, he said to the man in the wrong, "Why are you choosing to make physical contact, to strike and afflict?" Read Yom Kippurim, your fellow countrymen. And so he answered, "Who set you in charge as judge over us? Will you kill me as that as it is said that you killed that Mitzri?" As a result, Moshe was concerned, and he said to himself, "Indeed, this statement is known and accepted." And he would walk away for 40 years.
Yeah, well, combine them.
That is the story for Yisrael. If you are a Jew and someone sends you this program and you're listening, this is your history. This is what you have done. It's time to undo the damage. We can't correct the nation of Israel, but we most certainly can correct the thinking and the response of individual Yehuda. Don't be one of those that says, "Who made you judge and jury over us?" Instead, thank Yahweh for providing the means to walk away from all of the harassment of human religious and political schemes, and then the reward of being able to live with him forever in his home. This is the celebration of Pesach and Matzah. Well, that was about as profound as anything that I've had the opportunity to share on this program in a long time, and I hope it resonates with Yisrael. It's been a long time.
Yeah,
now, of course, the proper... Go ahead, Kirk.
No, I was just saying, I hope people get a chance to read it. We, as much as you've covered, there's so much more in this chapter, and it's such a, I mean, it's got some wonderful insights. I thought, you know, not as important, obviously, but just your chapter on about page 23 about the Lowy, known as the Levite, and what their responsibility is so far removed from what you think of a priest. That's exactly what they're supposed to be doing. I mean, it is the Pesach offering, and it's just you've done well.
Let's bring the people.
Yeah,
bring the people back together.
Yeah.
This is the call that Yahweh has into the purpose of Pesach. The proper perspective was to free the slaves and to discipline those who had been abusing them. Instead, the leader of the people, the Pharaoh, lashed out and tried to kill the lone moral individual in their midst. Such is the nature of man. When Pharaoh heard what was said about this, he sought to kill Moshe. But Moshe fled, driven away from the presence of Pharaoh. He settled in the land of Midian, and he established a dwelling place near a well. The differences, Kirk, may be considerable, but let's compare.
Mm-hmm.
America's response to Edward Snowden. He showed uncommon courage and concern for his nation by exposing the intrusive, disingenuous, and abusive nature of the government harassing its own people. For his generosity, for his good judgment, for his heroism, the leaders of that government have labeled him a traitor and have caused him to flee for his life. It is the way we say thank you
to men of truth and valor. You know, I'm devote 8 to 10 hours a day, 6 days a week to this project. And you know that these programs get posted where the single most prevalent comment is now, people attacking me because I'm encouraging folks to be vaccinated so that we can at least make the most of the disintegrating conditions around us. And yet they want to promote their myths, discredit me along with themselves. And, well, I'm irrelevant with one exception, and that is that Yahweh chose to reveal his message and to call his people home through what we're doing. And anything that discredits that is an attack on God. And you ought to be really careful if you're pretending that that you're a truther outing me for telling the truth when there is so much evidence that God chose this vehicle to convey his message and call his people home.
Well, like we've always said, if not this, who?
If not this, who?
I mean, come on.
And it's so, yeah, and it's so obvious that it's this. As a matter of fact, in the midst of all of this, we're going to find, guess who? Sennacherib. The priest of Midian, contentiousness, had 7 daughters who were shepherding sheep. They came and drew water from a well and filled the watery trough to allow their father's flock to drink. As the nature of man, there would be some good Cohen priests who would serve to help the people appreciate Yahweh's desire to liberate us from the hostile nature of men. But there would be many more clerics and royal advisors who would perform religious rites to bind people to the myths of pagan gods. The overwhelming preponderance of clerics and kings would be Midian, a source of belligerent contention, by deceptively misleading the people and bringing everyone down in the process. But Yahweh, even in the midst of this, never misses a chance to reinforce his message. And in this case, Sheba 7. It is the Malay, the completion and fulfillment of Yahweh's Sheba promise to bring us together. 6 is the number of man with God who is one, is Sheba 7. He would provide 6 steps through his Mikre to lead us to the 7th, which is his Sukkah home. Now, Yahweh interacts with us like a shepherd. He cares for and leads his flock like a father fulfills the needs of his children. But not all shepherds are caring. To protect us from them, Yahweh has provided a means to Yasha, deliver and save his sheep. I'm impressed, by the way, with Moshe. He did some things that are truly, truly courageous with character. And then the shepherds came and they drove them away. But Moshe, he took a stand and he rescued them and gave their sheep a drink. The first time Yasha is used in the story of the Exodus, we find the great liberator defining its primary meaning, which is to rescue and to deliver and not to save.
Yeah, that's significant.
In fact, salvation is a byproduct of Yahweh's willingness to Yasha liberate his children, freeing us from the tyrannical nature of man. It is essential to understand that the religious have it all wrong. The goal isn't to be saved,
to be
freed from their religion. Because it's only then that we can engage in a liberated, freeing, and eternal relationship with our Father. Now, this is vital to our understanding, especially of the relationship Yahweh intends through his covenant. As we should expect from a loving Father, salvation is not one of the benefits ascribed to accepting the conditions of the covenant. Fathers protect their children.
delivering them from harm's way, liberating them to be all they can be. The role of a father is not to save his children. Moshe demonstrated what few are willing to do today. He took a stand against the prevailing culture. In his case, he prevented stronger male shepherds from imposing their will and running off the physiologically weaker women. It was the second of many times that he would reveal his character. Also, in both cases, Moshe risked his own life to intervene and protect others. He had nothing to gain other than to know he had done the right thing. In this regard, Moshe is a lot like Dode, demonstrating a characteristic that Yahweh treasures. He respects men who have a strong backbone, who are willing to stand up and oppose the prevailing influence of man's political and religious schemes. They would be the opposite of meek or accommodating. For far too long, Israelites have tried to fit in rather than standing apart.
That's a good line, yeah. That is true.
When they came to Ra'uel, Ra'uel means the will of God, from Ra'u and El, the desire and will of the Almighty, their father, he said, "Why is it that you have so frantically returned today?" Why would they frantically return? There's no fear here. They had witnessed something extraordinary. A man stood up and risked his own life to protect innocent people from the established who were stronger and were willing to abuse them. That is so rare that today people would be just as flabbergasted by it as they were here 3,500 years ago. They said, "A Mitzri man delivered us, sparing us away from the influence of the shepherds. And also, he drew water for us so that we might understand. Then he allowed the flock to drink."
Oh, yeah.
With the name Ra'uel, will of God, we should see the seven daughters of Father representing the will of our Heavenly Father. And through this story, Moshe represents the implement of Yahweh's intent. The women were excited because they encountered an uncommon individual, someone who was willing to take a stand against unwarranted aggression. And in this case, by repeating the law, we are being encouraged to consider its full implications. By protecting the women and nurturing the sheep, Moshe was demonstrating something that we ought to understand, appreciating Yahweh's desire to do the same for his flock. There's a lesson in every word and deed. Then the father said to his daughters, "So where is he? Why did you abandon this man? You should want to invite him because he will want to eat leavened bread. Lekem. Indeed, Israel, where is he? Why have you abandoned and forsaken him? He has done so much for you, and yet you have brushed him aside." Just as Yahweh is inviting Yisrael into his home through the Mikre, invitations to be called out. You should, Kara, choose to welcome him into your life, answering his summons to be called out. Where is he, Yisrael? Is there any one of you celebrating Pesach tonight who are going to welcome Yahweh into your homes? Where is he? Why is the God of Yisrael never spoken of in your midst? What did you do to him? Where is he, Israel?
after delivering his people from the specter of death. It is Yahweh's desire to consume the leaven and the bread of life, removing the fungus of religion and politics so that we might be free of it. And should we accept God's offer, Yahweh will be as Moshe was. Moshe was pleased to accept the invitation, y'all, to live with this individual. And he gave his daughter, Zipporah, early bird, to Moshe. Without the intrigue of palace politics and the screams of the constant abuse of slaves, life would be more as God intended. Moshe was happy as a lark with his early bird.
And he's a lark. Good.
Yeah, Zipporah would conceive. She gave birth to a son. Now, to effectively, let me tell you, that was God's intent with all of this. Man was happy. You know, I can tell you, I'm living a wonderful life.
Happy.
I do not need right now to be spending 10 to 12 hours a day rewriting these books. I've got a wonderful life. But folks, it's the right thing to do.
Yeah, don't quit.
It's the right thing to do. And there's just so few people out there willing to do the right thing. To effectively serve with Yah, to liberate the children of Israel, bringing them home, Moshe would need to experience the joys and the frustrations of being a father. Although there would be more to it than this, because these were extraordinary circumstances, of course. Israel would be summoned out of the realm of human oppression on two occasions. The second of those is in our immediate future.
Yes.
Israel, like Moshe, would pass through Arabia en route to the Promised Land, and while it would be a place of great enlightenment, these were not their people, and this was not their home. He called him by the name Wakara Eshemhu. He invited him into his presence, designated in welcoming him by the name Gershom. Gershom means to take out. It's from Garash, to expel and drive out, taking away. Because he said, I am an invited guest dwelling, sojourning as a foreigner with a different people in another place. It's from Gur, to abide, to dwell, to stay, enjoying hospitality in a different and distant realm with someone else, an observant and discerning foreigner who is not of the same ethnicity or geographic location, and yet seems to understand this place.
Seems familiar.
This is the Nakir Yah. The Nakir Yah. With Yah's Nakri, someone from a place and culture that is not my own, speaking a different language, who, having paid attention, will comprehend. It is from Nakir, an individual who, by being attentive and astute, will come to be acquainted with, recognize, and acknowledge something which deserves our highest regard and respect in this realm and place, which is where the Torah would be revealed. This is Shemoth, Exodus 20:22. You know, even when I edited this for the seventh time, which was about 10 years ago,
yeah,
I had no idea that why Yahweh would say, Gur, I'm an invited guest dwelling as a foreigner and among a different people. Why would then he add Nakir Yah?
It's a precursor of the second coming out.
Because there's not one Exodus, but two.
Yeah.
There's not one Exodus, but two.
Moshe, the one who draws out, and you could almost say there's three in a way, because there was an exodus from Babylon.
Babylon, yeah.
Moshe, the one who draws out Kara, was called, indeed invited and summoned, now read, now even read about and recited, as having been announced and designated to call the children of Israel out of Ephraim by way of the Mikra. Even his son's name, Gershom, to take out, proclaimed as much. Ger would have been sufficient to explain Moshe's current situation. He was Ger, an invited guest dwelling as a foreigner, enjoying the hospitality of a different people and place. The introduction of the Nakri Yah's Nakri. At this, the pivotal moment in the life of Yisrael, at the moment Yahweh decided to rescue his people from the most foreign of lands, may serve as a foreshadowing of what is to come, a second Exodus. It may be nothing more than Moshe bemoaning that he was a Ger, a foreigner living in a Nakriya Eretz, a foreign place.
Uh-huh.
What is it? What is it? We are told that Moshe Ya'al was pleased to accept the invitation, willingly demonstrated that he was in complete agreement with his opportunity to begin life anew. He was totally content to live with, establishing a home with this individual, as happy as a lark with his early bird. Moshe was thrilled with his new life and his new wife. His adoptive family could not have been more accommodating. He was a new father, living safe and secure from the hell that he had left behind. He was not complaining. He was happy, so pleased with his home that when Yahweh asked him to go back to the place from which he had come, he said, no.
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 No, thanks.
With Moshe content to live out the rest of his life with his adoptive family, what's the alternative? Why is he introducing Yah's Nakri at this time and this place? As before, we can move past this reference and consider what Yahweh reveals next, which is the suffering of his people. Or we can linger here and ponder the prophetic implications. Yah's Nakri, while not unique among men, is special to Yahweh and important to his people. He is an implement chosen by Yahweh to convey his message to Yisrael, serving as a voice who calls out to God's people, inviting them to come home at a time when their own voice has gone silent. To appreciate this prophecy regarding the purpose of Yah's Nakri, we must jump ahead to the conclusion of the initial Exodus. The children of Yisrael were settled in the promised land. And as we continue, Kirk, and we'll go on for a little longer, we'll no longer be part of the live broadcast, but all of this will be recorded for the archive of this program. Will be posted in many places by many covenant members, and it's still being listened to by those who have called in to the listen line. And so let's continue through this thought.
Okay.
Which is the children of Yisrael, when they were finally settled in the promised land, with the recently constructed home of the covenant being dedicated in their presence, it was then that Shlomo, reconciliation, Solomon, Dode's son, revealed something which should still be reverberating around the world, something which should be considered by Jew and Gentile alike. God promised to provide someone who would show the way to the benefits of the relationship, who as a witness would provide answers regarding Yahweh's Shem, his name, his Yod, hand, that's his influence, his Shazak, his impassioned leader, and Zeruah, protective shepherd and sacrificial lamb. The rabbis even call that bone that they toss on the plate a Zeruah. And yet they haven't a clue that there were three Zeruah in Yah's story. Moshe was the first, Dod the second, and Yosha the third. By using this individual, God would help interested parties reconcile their relationship through evidence and reason, becoming part of his Perez family. As a matter of fact, Zeruah, which is that bone that they put on the Seder plate, it is Zeruah that led us to this declaration of Yah introducing the Nakar to the world. It is Passover's story. Using this individual, God would help interested parties reconcile their relationship through evidence and reason, becoming part of his Bereth family. Our Heavenly Father expressly, Kara, invited us to read what this Lama'an witness had to say. His Nakri, observant foreigner, who would come to Yada, know and understand by translating and contemplating his testimony. We were even encouraged to Asha, act upon this individual's conclusions, which means that he would be right about God, correctly presenting what Yahweh is offering, as well as what he expects in return. In a world of believers, of those who have gone astray, awash in many vile voices, Yahweh is offering us an opportunity to Yada, know him. Upon the completion and commemoration of Yah's Berith family home, which was the seminal moment in the life of a united Yisrael, standing atop Mount Moriah, with the recently completed temple shining in the background, the man noted for his wisdom delivered the original Sermon on the Mount. He was dedicating the building that Yahweh had designed to showcase the Ark of the Covenant, the tablets of stone, the original scroll of the Torah Moshe had scribed, in the very place Yah's Nakri was introduced. With Jacob's descendants gathered before him and speaking of the promises Yahweh had made to his father, David, while desirous of guiding his people's footsteps, Solomon used Nakri, a discerning foreigner from a distant place and time, speaking a different language, who, as a result of being observant, would come to understand, to tell the children of Yisrael and others how they should respond to the words this individual would write on their behalf. The timing strongly suggests that his translations and conclusions would become especially relevant to those being called out of Babylon prior to Yahweh's return, the second Exodus, and this time, God's final solution.
Yay.
After describing the importance of the Ark of the Covenant, which had been placed in the center of Yah's home, Solomon reiterated many of the wonderful things which would benefit Israel if the people continued to love Yahweh, to sing his father's songs, and to observe the Torah's guidance. But knowing that they would not, realizing that their descendants would require an exodus of their own, Solomon conveyed the following. Therefore, regarding someone else, an observant and discerning foreigner from a different ethnicity and geographic location, who will come to understand, Ha Nakri, who is not of your people, this Israel. He will come from a distant country in a distant time for the express purpose of being a reliable witness and providing truthful answers regarding your surprisingly
important name. The influence of your hand, along with the powerful and passionate ruler who is prepared to lead. All of these are references, by the way, to Dodd and to the protective and productive ram who shepherds the flock. The Zeroah is not a bone on the Seder's plate.
Yeah.
It is Dodd David. It is Moshe. It is the Passover lamb and Yosha, whom you have reached out and will extend. When he arrives on the scene and chooses to pursue this, then he will help interested parties reconcile their relationship by providing those who exercise good judgment with the information and justifications needed to make a correct and reasoned decision regarding this familial relationship. When you hear this out of the heavens, coming from the atmosphere, when you listen to what comes out of the spiritual realm by the way of the sky, perhaps prophetic of radio waves and especially satellite-based broadband internet connections, now archived in the cloud under Yada Yahwa, within the location where you live, then engage and act accordingly, doing everything which to show the way the observant foreigner from a different ethnicity and geographic location who understands has invited you to read for the express purpose of being a witness who provides answers such that every person on earth will have a genuine and ongoing opportunity to become familiar with, to know, to acknowledge, to accept, and to understand your name, coming to respect and revere you simultaneously along with your people, Yisrael, and so that they may know that truthfully your family and this house, which to reveal the correct path to walk, to give life meaning, that I have built for the family, who are designated and called by your name. So you should remember that indeed you were a slave in the land of the crucibles of oppression. And Yahweh, your God, brought you out from there with a mighty and firm, powerful and protective hand. And with the sacrificial lamb and the productive arm shepherding the flock. For this reason, Yahweh, your God, instructed you to approach by observing that which is associated with the time to celebrate the Shabbat, such that it is set apart and special. We transitioned from Solomon's speech, which is recorded in Devarim HaYomim, Words of the Day, 2 Chronicles 6:33, to Moshe's, because guess what? The four key terms that drove that initial assessment that was made at the Sermon on the Mount are the same four terms.
Mm-hmm.
Drive Moshe's thoughts and the Devarim words, Deuteronomy 5:15. Now, as we consider the implications of these statements, one from Solomon and two from Moshe, we are approaching the ultimate celebration of the Shabbat. Surviving Israelites will soon be coming home to participate in Yom Kippur on the Day of Reconciliations in the Yobel year of 6,000 Yah sunset. October 2nd, 2033. A friend of mine, a fact checker, Mike Bellotti, pointed something out that I did not see, but it's I want to share his thoughts on this because it is interesting. It's something that we don't consider very often.
And what I wrote based upon his analysis is to say that while the current Greek rendition of Revelation is suspect, the sections of it which emerge from the prophets, notably the Mizmor, Zechariah, Daniel, Yechezkel, Yeshayah, Yirmiyah, and Malachi, can be reassuring and enlightening. Such an example may be the two witnesses, of whom only Eliyah is named. If they remain active for the 1,260 days presented in Revelation, followed by the 3.5 days as foretold after they are killed before they ascend to heaven on Yom Kippurim, then 1,264 days earlier, Eliyah will be arriving just in time to celebrate Passover on Wednesday, April 17th, 2030. And you know what's so fascinating about that? The one thing the rabbis actually got right, they always set a place for Eliyah at the Passover table. There's always a plate, a goblet of wine for Eliyah at the Passover table. And guess what? That is the day he's going to return to be a witness along with the other to Yisrael.
Wow.
Isn't that beautiful?
That's pretty cool. You're kidding. Wow. Thanks, Mike.
Yeah, so, yeah, well, thank you for sharing this wonderful story of the liberation from Mitzrayim and how Mitzrayim represents all that man has become, the worst of man. Every nation, every civilization, every religious institution, and your desire to lead us away from what man has concocted to oppress and enslave and subjugate other men and women. Thank you for leading us away from it. Thank you for creating the means that we might live rather than die at the hands of men, that we might enter your doorway of life into your home, while at the same time we celebrate your willingness to cleanse our souls of religious and political corruption so that we are perfected and that you're able to adopt us. That is the story of Pesach, of Matzah, and of Bikurim. So thank you, Yah. What a wonderful celebration as we celebrate this Pesach, this Matzah, and this Bikurim with you. May Yah bless. Have a wonderful Shabbat. I think that you are like us. Well, certainly what we did tonight is that we celebrated a wonderful, wonderful Passover Pesach meal, knowing that we'll have so much more time to celebrate it tomorrow. So we're gonna have a Hezekiah.
Do it again. Hezekiah.
We're gonna do it again. We had a wonderful time celebrating tonight. We're going to celebrate it again tomorrow. And because it is a celebration of life, it's a celebration of entering into Yahweh's home. It's a celebration of him perfecting us and then of him adopting us. It is a marvelous thing that we can and should celebrate all the days of our lives.
Yes.
Wow. May Yah bless.
Well done, my friend.
Good night, y'all. Happy Shabbat and happy Pesach. Yes. Happy Matzah. Happy Bikurim. Yes. We'll be with you at this time again next week as we conclude the celebration of Matzah. Good night.
Shalom. Good night.
Good night.